From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump appears to be fuming over yesterday's FBI raid on the home and office of his longtime personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. One of his tweets read this morning, "Attorney-client privilege is dead." Here to help us unpack the reason for the FBI's raid and the president's angry response to it is Carrie Johnson, who covers the Justice Department for NPR. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Lisa.
The president's attorney, Michael Cohen, has his own attorney, and that attorney calls the raid an unnecessary seizure of protected attorney-client communications, which echoes the president's tweet today. Is there anything about attorney-client privilege that would prevent the FBI from seizing Cohen's documents if he's being investigated?
Attorney-client privilege is supposed to protect communications, conversations, legal advice between a lawyer and a client. And as far as we're able to tell, what the FBI wants from Michael Cohen, President Trump's lawyer and friend, is beyond, is not just conversations or communications he's had with President Trump about legal cases or issues involving President Trump, but in fact, some things about Michael Cohen's own business dealings and business interests. So the scope of this raid is far beyond the nature of his attorney-client relationship with President Trump. What's more, Michael Cohen played the role of a deal maker to some extent in the Trump organization, and it's not at all clear to me that he was acting as an attorney in that capacity. To the extent the FBI wants materials, documents, electronic communications about that, that also appears to be fair game.
Okay. It was not the special counsel Robert Mueller's team that executed this. It was the FBI. So what's the connection to the Mueller investigation?
As far as we're able to tell, this information came through the transom to Special Counsel Robert Mueller. He took it to the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who's his boss, and Rosenstein decided that this matter should be handled by the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York, the top federal prosecutor in Manhattan. That's under whose auspices this raid was carried out yesterday.
Okay, so Rosenstein signed off on it, basically said, go ahead.
Yeah. In fact, something of this nature, a raid on an office of a lawyer and a residence of a lawyer, requires special Justice Department approvals, both at the U.S. Attorney's Office and at Main Justice. We understand that people in the Criminal Division and the Deputy Attorney General's Office had to approve this raid under DOJ procedures and that they did so.
Attorney Michael Cohen, at the center of the raid, says that he paid $130,000 of his own money to the porn star known as Stormy Daniels. Daniels says it was basically to hush her up about an affair that she had with the president. Donald Trump denies the affair and says he didn't know anything about the payment either. Remind us why Michael Cohen is under the microscope and what we know about what the FBI seized in the raids.
Well, Michael Cohen has acknowledged paying this woman, Stephanie Clifford, also known as Stormy Daniels. She's trying to challenge that agreement in court, and some materials with respect to the agreement have come out through Stormy Daniels' interviews and her attorney. One of the bases for the raid, as far as we understand it, is whether Michael Cohen may have violated any election laws. And there are open questions as to whether his payment to Stormy Daniels in the waning days of the election constituted some kind of benefit to President Trump's campaign that he should have reported as such. Of course, the New York Times is now reporting that among the materials the FBI seized yesterday were documents with respect to Stormy Daniels, also known as Stephanie Clifford, and documents related to Karen McDougal, another woman, a former Playboy playmate who claimed she had an affair with President Trump and that she was later paid off through the holding company that owns the National Enquirer to stay quiet about it.
So how close would the seizure of those documents, depending on what happens with them, bring the Justice Department and the Mueller investigation to Michael Cohen? And how close does that bring them to Donald Trump?
We don't yet know. Lisa, what happens in the course of these raids is that the person who's the owner of the property or the subject of the raid gets a short piece of paper suggesting what kinds of things the government is looking for, although not a roadmap or a blueprint to what the FBI is seeking. Later on in the course of the investigation, the FBI will be required to file an inventory or what's called returns, listing what they found and giving that ultimately to the subject of the investigation. We're some ways away from that now, but rest assured, a judge and ultimately Michael Cohen will get a list of what everything the FBI has in its possession here, and that will give us a signal as to what they're looking at and what they have found.
All right. And the president's outrage at the raid yesterday has fueled more speculation that he could be considering firing Robert Mueller. Does that seem more likely now? What are you hearing?
The White House has been pretty quiet about that. Notable, though, Lisa, several Republicans in Congress, including Lindsey Graham, a senator from South Carolina, and Chuck Grassley, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee from Iowa, have both advised the president in public today not to fire Robert Mueller, not to fire the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. To do so, Grassley says, would be suicide. Lindsey Graham says he thinks the president is smarter than that. Democrats on Capitol Hill are not so sure. They're still pushing legislation that would give some job security to Robert Mueller in the months ahead.
Carrie Johnson, who covers the Justice Department for NPR. Thanks a lot, Carrie.
My pleasure.
Let's take a look now at Alabama, which is one of seven states that exempt religious daycare providers from licensing and inspection requirements. Critics say that loophole has endangered children and even led to one child's death. Alabama's governor has signed a new law requiring that all religiously exempt daycares meet the minimum health and safety standards set by the state. But as Troy Public Radio's Kyle Gassett reports, some advocates say the law does not go far enough.
The pictures are like teardrops raining from the sky, like someone who tries to cry. The music is
9-year-old Kamari Hopper reads a poem that she wrote during one of her homeschool lessons. Her mother, Kim, has been teaching Kamari and her two brothers at home after they got violently ill at their daycare center in Montgomery, Alabama. Kamari says it was the sickest she's ever been.
Someone was pushing it up from my stomach and I had to stand on my tiptoes because that's how bad it was hurting.
Kim Hopper took her daughter and son to the emergency room and found it full of other kids from the daycare and some of the teachers who were also ill. At the hospital, she also met the center's owner.
She was looking very distraught. She apologized for everything that was going on because I was still like, well, what happened? No one was safe.
Hopper later learned that 86 children got sick because the daycare wasn't following health regulations and kids had been served contaminated food. The daycare center hadn't been visited by the health department in the last year because it was religiously affiliated and exempt from annual fire and health inspections. In Mobile, Alabama, no one had inspected community nursery and preschool academy or run background checks on workers at the religious daycare center. Camden Johnson, a 5-year-old at that daycare, died after being left in a hot van by a worker who had a prior felony record. That includes a charge of not properly restraining a child in a car. Camden died a few months after a bill that would have mandated background checks on daycare workers got voted down in the state legislature. Peblin Warren is the representative who proposed the bill. She reads from a letter she wrote to her colleagues before she reintroduced the bill.
If we would have passed this bill in May last year, this lady wouldn't be allowed to work there, okay? This kid wouldn't be dead.
Warren's bill was signed into law in late March and goes into effect immediately. So now, all religiously affiliated daycares in Alabama that are exempt from being licensed have to meet the minimum health and safety standards set by the state. The law doesn't force all religious daycares to become licensed, but it does say that any center that receives state funding will have to get a license, and that has some religious groups worried.
We see this as the camel's nose under the tent that leads to more and more government control.
John Eadsmo is with the Foundation for Moral Law, founded by former Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore. Eadsmo agrees that regular safety inspections should be required, but he says that forced licensing of religious daycares means the government could begin to interfere with what many view as a ministry. He says by design, these daycares answer to a different authority.
Ultimately, there's accountability to God, too. The fact you put the state in charge doesn't mean everything is going to go well.
If you leave loopholes and opportunities open, you cannot guarantee who or who isn't going to jump through those loopholes.
Melanie Bridgeforth is the president of Voices for Alabama's Children, which lobbied the legislature on behalf of the bill. She says currently there are close to 1,000 unlicensed, largely unregulated daycare centers in the state. That's 35% of all Alabama daycares. And Bridgeforth says that number is only going to get higher.
We do nothing about it. By 2027, license-exempt programs could make up more than 63% of all child care in Alabama, and that is the crux of the situation.
Representative Warren says there's language in the law that keeps the government from infringing on any religious practice or teaching. The law's main goal is to make sure a church's daycare is regularly inspected, just as other parts of the building are.
They can't build a church without going to a city or a county government to get a permit. They can't do a lot of things without having inspections.
Warren says the next bill she's going to propose will require that exempt daycare centers provide parents with a pamphlet that thoroughly explains what being a licensed daycare means and, more importantly, what it doesn't. For Here and Now, I'm Kyle Gassett in Montgomery, Alabama.
West Virginia has become the first state to allow some people to vote in a federal election using blockchain technology. A blockchain is a network of computers that exchange data in a way that makes it difficult to hack. And right now, some service members deployed overseas are using the technology through a mobile app called Votes to cast their ballot in the state's May 8th primary. Mac Warner is West Virginia's Secretary of State. Mr. Warner, welcome.
Thank you.
When I hear the word blockchain, I think of cybersecurity, I think of Bitcoin. I do not think of elections and voting. So how would this work?
Well, the key to that is the vendor is the one who chose blockchain as a means to secure it. My direction to my elections officials were to simply find a way to increase voter participation by members of the active duty military, because when I was on active duty, I had difficulty in voting on several occasions, and my children have all served, and they also experienced that difficulty. So my elections officials went in search of a solution. What they found on the other end was kind of a three-way partnership between the Secretary of State in West Virginia, our voters, and the vendor, then with Bradley Tusk, who is a philanthropist, being the fourth is the financial means behind it.
So you've got this idea. Now, how do you make it happen? I understand some military members who are registered in two counties in West Virginia have already started voting with this app. How does it work? How do you actually do it?
Okay. The voter applies through the county clerk through the normal process and makes sure that they are registered. At that point, the county clerk knows how many people there are. They provide that to the vendor, Votes, and Votes then notifies the soldier they are registered to vote and they can vote the ballot. When they're ready, all the voter then has to do, the soldier, is download the Votes app, and then the voting takes place through the app. There are several layers of security in this. The first, the soldier has to take a photo of their military, either ID, a driver's license, perhaps a passport, and then they take a selfie, and the facial recognition in the app compares the photo with the selfie to make sure that you've got one person that's registered to vote doing the actual voting.
Well, I'm glad you talked about security, because I'm sure you know that Americans are very skeptical about the security of their ballot right now after we learned that Russians tried to hack the voting systems of 21 states in 2016. How can you be sure that this can't be hacked?
Well, so far to date, what happens after the voter votes, then they secure that by the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And that is a secure form that has not been hacked to date. It is being used in the financial world. It's used in transportation systems. It's used on Wall Street. The medical community is using it. And to date, no one has hacked blockchain. So that is how the digital vote is secured in a digital lockbox until Election Day. Mm-hmm. And then the county clerk uses a biometric key that allows them to unlock the lockbox to get at the vote.
Well, as all this is happening, President Trump said that one strategy to fight back on Russian meddling in our elections is to lean on paper ballots. And here he is speaking during a news conference last month with the Swedish prime minister. Let's listen to that.
One of the things we're learning is it's always good. It's old-fashioned, but it's always good to have a paper backup system of voting. It's called paper, not highly complex computers, paper.
What do you think of that? As you try to move West Virginia into a much more tech-savvy future, does what the president said make sense to you?
It does, and two things here. One is we will produce a paper ballot in this process as soon as that digital lockbox is open. So that's one piece. The other is think of the disenfranchised military voters, and who more than a military serviceman, either in a submarine off the coast of North Korea or Syria or a soldier on a hillside in Afghanistan, who better deserves the right to vote in our process? And it's difficult for them to get that piece of paper in the mail on a hillside in Afghanistan. So this is a solution to a problem that enfranchises military voters, and that's what we're out to solve, is that difficulty.
What else are you doing in West Virginia to systematically ensure the safety of your elections? I understand you've also hired a cybersecurity expert.
We have, and this came from a disconnect between the secret world that the CIA and FBI and some of those people operate in as they protect sources and methods. When they learned that the Russians were hacking, that was not immediately available to those of us who were secretaries who did not have the security clearances. So our own federal government was aware of information, but they couldn't share it with the elected officials. We live in a very transparent world where we have to keep the citizenry on our side because we can convince them of the integrity of the system. So there was a disconnect between these two cultures.
Are you saying the person you've hired has security clearance?
They do. They have a top secret security clearance through the National Guard, so they can get that information that's needed from those three-lettered agencies, and then they can convert that and tell me what I need to be doing, maybe not in the classified arena, although I now have a interim security clearance. But we can work together to solve that problem and keep our secure.
Mac Warner, Secretary of State of West Virginia, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And here's another story about old school paper technology. There's a children's book out today about the founding of the first bookmobile in the early 1900s. Mary Lemest Titcomb was the library in Washington County, Maryland, who came up with the idea of bringing books to the people. Charlie Glenn's book is called Library on Wheels, and she joins us now from KUER in Salt Lake City. Charlie, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. And a book wagon in the age of the internet sounds so quaint, but it was an idea that was really ahead of its time, I guess.
It was. And the fact that it was a woman who came up with not only did she come up with the idea of what we now call the bookmobile, but she actually designed the very first one. It was a horse-drawn wagon pulled by two horses named Dandy and Black Beauty.
Nice. So she made this, and we're going to talk more about the wagon first, but let's dig into more of her life. She was, as you say, a woman who was working at a time when not many women did.
Right. Really, the only careers open to women at that time were nursing or teaching, and neither of those really appealed to her. But she learned that there was a new field, librarianship, and that appealed to her. There were no formal training programs at that time. So she had to sort of apprentice herself. And this was at a library in Concord, Massachusetts. And so she learned how to be a librarian and then was asked to come. So it's an interesting story. Public lending libraries were a pretty new thing in America. The movement sort of started in New England, but there was a forward-thinking individual in Hagerstown, Maryland. And he felt that not just Hagerstown, but the entire county needed a library.
Because books at the time and libraries at the time were for the rich. They were for the
That's
well-educated.
Right.
They weren't
That's
for
right.
rural farmers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So he raised the money to build a library, and then he had to go find a librarian to run it. And so he went to New England and found Mary Lemest Titcomb.
Then she realizes once she's there that she needs to find a way to get people who live far away from this library.
Right.
She needs to take the books to the people. So she designs the wagon.
Exactly. Hagerstown is the county seat of Washington County, which is 500 square miles. About half of the population of the county, 25,000 lived in Hagerstown, but there were 25,000 other residents of the county that lived in outlying areas. And so there were a lot of farmers and outlying villages and farms that they never made it into the library in Hagerstown. And she felt very strongly that if this was to be a county library, it needed to serve the entire county.
And it was so new to people.
It was
you write
so very
that somebody
new.
Thought it looked like a hearse or that it was a hearse.
Exactly.
It was not carrying a body. It was carrying books. Well, look, how did the book wagon evolve over the years?
It began, as I say, as a horse-drawn wagon that could hold about 200 books. The second book wagon was actually motorized. It could hold about 300 books. There has been, from that time, from 1905 was when the first book wagon made its maiden voyage, until now, there has always been a book wagon bookmobile in Washington County,
Maryland. In fact, there are pictures in your book of the bookmobile and the book wagon over the years. There's a picture even from 2016. What would Mary Titcomb think of the state of libraries today?
I think she would be thrilled to know what came of her idea of the bookmobile. In the 1960s and 70s, which was sort of the heyday, there were over 2,000 functioning bookmobiles across America. That's fallen off a little bit.
Well, I guess that's my point. You know, my mother-in-law is a public librarian not too far from where you are right now in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and she was telling me recently that the bookmobile for her library was a victim of budget cuts a couple of years ago.
Yes,
so that was,
yes.
That was
and my bookmobile, where I grew up in the Uinta Basin here in Utah, also no longer exists, which is very sad because the bookmobile, to me, was everything.
Really?
I grew up in northeastern Utah in a small rural farming community, and there were seven children in my family. My father died in a mining accident when I was five. We didn't have a lot of money. The nearest library was 15 miles away from our home, but every 2 weeks, the bookmobile pulled up in front of R.G. Ross's farm in my little farming community and brought the universe to me in the form of books to read.
So it's personal.
It's very personal, yes. And there's still a use for the bookmobile, not only in rural areas, but in South America, for example. In some places, they use burros to carry books to remote areas. Or in the Middle East and Africa, they use camels. You know, this idea that she had of the need of getting books to people, not just the elite, but everyone, there's still a need for that, certainly.
Charlie Glenn's new book is Library on Wheels. Charlie, thanks for writing it, and thanks for coming in to speak with us about it.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Peter.
And we've got those pictures at hereandnow.org. The federal deficit is expected to soar past $1 trillion in 2020, according to a new report from the Congressional Budget Office. And in the next 10 years, the country's debt will be almost as great as its entire annual economic output. This is the latest CBO assessment after Republicans passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut last year, and since both parties agreed to a $1.3 trillion spending bill last month. So what are the implications of so much debt? Let's bring in Ali Velshi. He's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, welcome back. It's good to have you, as
always. Hi, Peter. Good to talk to you.
So let's be fair and just say that there were trillion-dollar deficits in the Obama administration.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that. We can talk about it. But there's also been some reporting in the past day or so that suggests the looming debt that the CBO is describing could trigger an economic crisis in the coming years. I mean, what are you hearing about
that? Yeah, let's give a little perspective. One is, you know, obviously the deficit is 1 year's shortage, and the debt is the accumulation of all of those shortages. And what the CBO is saying is that economic growth is going to average 1.9% per year for the next 10 years. Now, that's very different. During the campaign, President Trump was promising 4, 5, and 6%, and his people have routinely been saying 3%. 1.9% is not terrible for a mature economy. It's just less than what the president has been promising. So that's the issue. We're going to have lower economic growth than we thought. And the tax cuts cost money. So they're going to add $1.6 trillion to the deficit. The promise has been all the strong economic growth will offset that and won't be as bad as that. Well, what the Congressional Budget Office is saying is that it will be as bad as that.
So it's not that was not part of the promise, by the way.
Correct.
The report projects that interest rates, because of this, are likely going to rise. Could you walk us through that? Is it because that once you get huge deficits, you start turning on the engine of inflation? Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, that's, I think, a third of it. Part of it is that interest rates are on their way up. We know that. We've had unusually low interest rates for a long time to help with the recovery from the recession. So the Fed had already signaled that interest rates were going to go up, and they have been going up. That's number one. Number two, what tends to happen is when an economy heats up, the Fed's tool to keep it from heating up too much is to increase interest rates. So it was going to do that to cool up a heating economy. But the third part, and this is the important part as it relates relates to the increase in debt. Over the long term, when America starts to carry debt that is, as you said, almost as big as its economic output, well, it becomes a little riskier, and people need greater enticement to invest in the U.S. dollar, and that's why interest rates have to be a little higher in order to keep selling these bonds that finance our debt. So I wouldn't read too much into it. You know, back when Greece was having problems, people saying, well, America's on the way to being Greece. There are a lot of reasons why America isn't Greece, but there are also a lot of reasons that as we surpass our GDP in debt, you know, investors around the world, wealthy investors, sovereign funds, other countries say, you know what, to invest in the U.S. dollar, I need a little bit more. You need to sweeten the pot a little.
Now, the House is voting on Thursday on a constitutional amendment that would bar the government from spending more than it takes in. We could do a whole other segment on that, Ali. We just don't have time. But, I mean, we should say that they're doing that in the context of the fact that lawmakers just passed a huge spending bill and major tax cuts. So it is a little confusing to some people. We have Ali Velshi with MSNBC. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
In Puerto Rico, 283 schools are set to be shut down this summertime for good. The closings are expected to save millions of dollars amid the deep economic crisis. But they're raising questions about the future of public education on the island. Donica Couto is reporter for the Associated Press in San Juan, Puerto Rico. She joins us on Skype. Thanks for being here, Donica.
Thank you for having me.
283 more schools closing sounds like a lot. I wonder if you can give us a sense of the scale of the closings, because they follow previous closings.
Sure. Actually, from 2010 to 2015, Puerto Rico closed 150 schools. And then last year, it announced it would close another 167 schools. So this is the largest announcement so far of school closures in recent history. But education officials say that there's been a drop in enrollment of more than 38,700 students since last May. And in addition to that, after Hurricane Maria struck the island in September, there's been an estimated 135,000 families who have left as well.
And those who are leaving since Hurricane Maria, is that because of the condition of the schools or some other reason?
It's a variety of factors. Most of the schools did not have water or power, you know, at least 2 or 3 months after the hurricane hit. And post-hurricane, it's just been very difficult for many people to find another job or to wait, you know, to see if their company was going to reopen.
So are teachers and staff who worked in those schools also leaving?
Some of them have been leaving. There's about 4,700 teachers that remain and that will be affected by these school closures. But the Secretary of Education promises that they will not be laid off. They will instead be transferred to some of the remaining 828 schools that will remain open across the island.
So what happens to the quality of education in those schools that will remain open? And what is the quality of education there like across the board anyway?
It depends. Some schools, as the Secretary of Education has recognized, have very good education. Some others, you know, there's been a lack of teachers. There's been a lack of supplies. And so part of the plan is to consolidate these schools and use that money. They expect to save about $14 million and use that money to improve education. In addition to that, the governor recently signed a bill that would create charter school programs as well as private school vouchers.
So that's a big issue there, that the governor wants to create charter schools and school voucher programs. But is there a demand for that on the island?
Not too much by parents. The knee-jerk reaction here is, oh, well, that's privatizing schools. That's putting public funds into private money. How do we know that that's not going to be, you know, end up in corruption, mismanagement? So those are some of the concerns that you hear from parents when you talk to them.
Is there no expectation that some of those who have migrated to the mainland will not come back?
There's a big expectation that those who have left will remain there. Economists here have said, you know, if once families find a job, once they find a place to rent, or if they bought a place and they're stable, that they won't be coming back. I mean, Puerto Rico right now, at nearly 7 months since Hurricane Maria struck, there's still more than 50,000 power customers without electricity. You know, there's still a lot of uncertainty over the economic crisis. They're trying to implement a fiscal plan that the governor and the Financial Oversight Board have not agreed upon. So in many people's minds, especially those who have left, the island is not stable enough yet to come back to.
Getting back to the issue of the governor's push for charter schools in Puerto Rico, is there an organized opposition to that happening?
There's been a handful of protests, and they're growing every week. So far, I think parents are waiting to see which schools will come under the charter schools pilot program. So far, they have not received a list yet. So I think once, you know, the Department of Education releases that list, you'll see, you know, some possibly organized opposition to it.
What's the bigger picture here, Danica? Because since, I mean, obviously the island has been having significant financial trouble. The troubles continue because of Hurricane Maria. Is the plan here to kind of triage the education system? Is it to recast now the education system, even given the lack of students right now? I mean, what's the bigger plan?
Sure. The governor, as part of the bill that he signed, they're overhauling the education system. I mean, the Department of Education here in Puerto Rico has long been known for its bureaucracy, its inefficiency, its inability to handle its resources. You know, teachers have long complained that they've always had to buy their own supplies, that they don't get textbooks, that the books that they do use are at least a decade old. And so part of the overhaul that they're doing, they hope to say that 70% of the budget for the Department of Education will go directly towards schools. So it's, you know, a long way. It's a long process. It'll be a couple of years before, you know, parents believe they'll see any changes. But the plan is to overhaul the Department of Education.
Well, given the different options for that happening and the lack of school-aged children now, because many have migrated from the island to the mainland, I wonder if this is seen as education becoming another casualty, maybe a longer-term casualty of Hurricane Maria, because you can repair the infrastructure, you can repair an electrical grid, but it's harder to repair the educational system. What's the attitude there?
Sure. I think parents are just very distrustful of the government. You know, there's been a couple of changes in recent years, schools closing. If you talk to some parents, they've said that their children have already changed schools twice. And so, you know, they're not happy with that instability. And they also worry the government keeps saying that it's running out of money, that it's unable to pay its debt. And so they wonder really how effective this overhaul will be and how much money will be assigned to it. So they're kind of waiting to see what will happen with the charter school program, the private school vouchers. You know, parents feel that already children in most schools are not getting the education, you know, that they deserve. And they wonder if these changes will bring about, you know, anything positive for the future.
Speaking to us about the closing schools in Puerto Rico, Danica Coto, Associated Press reporter in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Now to Wyoming, where county governments are supposed to be benefiting from a state tax on mineral companies. That tax helps pay for road maintenance, police salaries, education, and more. But as Wyoming Public Media's Cooper McKim reports, counties are not getting that money because the system to collect the funds is not working.
When you look past the courthouse in downtown Pinedale, a small town in eastern Wyoming, there are rolling hills dotted with sagebrush and oil and gas rigs. The companies that own those rigs are taxed after they extract oil or gas. Too often, critics say, those companies don't pay that tax. From the years 2006 to 2016, Sublette County lost more than $300,000. County Clerk Mary Lankford explains why that hurts.
We're dependent on that money to run our shop, run our, you know, all of our different departments, our law enforcement, our jail, the whole bit. And the money doesn't come. Here we are, we've committed the money, we've budgeted the money, and the payments don't get made, so we're short of money.
The annual tax that's being missed is called ad valorem. In Sublette County, ad valorem taxes account for 90% of the budget. The problem with these tax payments going unpaid is systematic. Legally, a company has up to 18 months to pay the tax, leaving plenty of time for things to go wrong, from bankruptcies to selling off assets to simply deciding not to pay. Lankford says Sublette and other counties have to blindly put together budgets without knowing when or how much mineral companies will be paying in taxes.
That's a nerve-wracking situation because we then have to have a contingency. We have to have a reserve out here to say, okay, what happens if these payments don't get made?
Counties can also miss out on funds because they're not first priority in debt collections when there is a bankruptcy. For example, in 2015, Alpha Natural Resources and its subsidiary went bankrupt, leaving Campbell County with more than $19 million in unpaid taxes. the county has already spent over $370,000 in legal fees fighting the loss. Head of the Wyoming Mining Association, Travis Detai, says Alpha will pay back its debts eventually. But legally, banks are ahead of counties in the debt collection process.
And I know it's frustrating for counties. I mean, they're owed money, and they've got that money committed, and they rely on it. And it's just one of those things to where, you know, they've got a time frame to pay it off.
Mike Madden, who chairs the Wyoming House Revenue Committee, says reforms are overdue. While the county collects ad valorem taxes every 18 months, the state collects the tax every month and has significantly lower delinquency rates.
Which tells me that obviously part of the problem, or if not the majority of the problem, is that we don't synchronize and have property taxes due at the same time that severance taxes are due.
There was legislation in 2016 that would fix the problem, but energy companies helped defeat the bill. No bills arose this session to discuss changing annual payments to monthly, though legislation did pass both state houses to help counties in the bankruptcy process. The governor has since signed it. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McCann.
Despite mounting tensions between the United States and China, President Trump recently signed a law encouraging U.S. officials to visit Taiwan. China considers Taiwan a rogue province, and for decades, China has pressured other countries not to recognize Taiwanese sovereignty. This new travel act could be seen as challenging China in its own backyard. Bonnie Glazer has been following this. She's senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bonnie, welcome.
Thank you.
President Trump signed this bill recently with very little fanfare. It went through Congress without opposition. Why do you think lawmakers felt compelled to make this statement?
I think that members of Congress are concerned about growing Chinese pressure on Taiwan and about the limited willingness of past U.S. administrations to do more to strengthen Taiwan's security, to sell arms, to help Taiwan participate in the international community. So I do think there's just growing concern about Taiwan's future, whether it will remain autonomous and prosperous.
Is it symbolic, or will we actually start to see top U.S. officials traveling to the island?
Well, the United States has sent cabinet members in the past to Taiwan, not very often. There was one sent during the Obama administration, and then prior to that, it was 14 years before that we had sent cabinet members. I think we will do that again under the Trump administration. Some of those people who go should go privately. There is no need to poke a finger in Beijing's eye, but sometimes public support, sometimes a symbolic person going, is necessary.
Well, what about China's reaction to this? The bill uses very specific language. It even gets close to calling Taiwan a sovereign country. I mean, how is Beijing responding? Does it see this as contradicting the One China policy?
Yes, the Chinese are quite concerned. They see this as a violation of the three joint communiques that the U.S. signed with China that says that we will preserve only unofficial relations with Taiwan. And yet I would say Washington and Beijing have always had different definitions of what is unofficial. I think what China really worries about is the slippery slope that today it could be a deputy assistant secretary, and indeed we sent two in the last 2 weeks, one from the Commerce Department, one from the State Department. But then it could potentially a Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense and their counterparts could come here from Taiwan, or maybe even Taiwan's president coming not to transit through the U.S. but as a real visit to Washington. And that would be alarming to China.
You could almost see that happening, considering some of the rhetoric that's happening between China and the United States right now. Of course, all of this is happening while a trade war is brewing. Do you see any connections there between these two?
Well, I personally don't see connections, but I know the Chinese do. The Chinese think that the United States is simply using Taiwan as a card to try and put pressure on China on trade.
Leverage.
Leverage, absolutely. Yeah. But I think that what the United States really just wants is more protection for Taiwan. We want to give Taiwan more dignity, and we do want to strengthen Taiwan's security.
Paul Smith at the U.S. Naval War College pointed out recently that the Travel Act comes at a time when China is upping air and naval operations around Taiwan, and that it could also further ignite military tensions between China, Taiwan, and the United States. Concern there for you?
Well, there's always a concern about Chinese military pressure on Taiwan. But the reality is that a lot of the exercises taking place are just PLA modernization. The Chinese have to train pilots. They do fly their aircraft, both bombers and fighters, around Taiwan. They've sailed their only aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, through the Taiwan Strait. But to get the Liaoning out into the sea for exercises, it must go either to the east or the west of Taiwan.
So you're saying they have no choice. It's not necessarily symbolic. It's just geographic.
I think it's a combination of geographic and also sending some warnings to Taiwan.
Well, there's also what's happening in the South China Sea. We're seeing reports this week that China has installed radar jamming technology on some of the islands it's built up there. The U.S. has just recently agreed to permit American defense contractors to help Taiwan build submarines. It does seem like there's some military antagonism between these countries, and I wonder how you think it compares to what we've seen historically.
Well, the height, I think, of the tensions in the Taiwan Strait was really 1995-96. That was when former President Lee Teng-hui had visited the United States, and the Chinese were really quite concerned about Taiwan going independent. Today, the problem is that China's military capability is so much greater than it was. And so if the Chinese decide that there's a lot of nationalist pressure on their leadership and they're losing legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, they could decide to attack Taiwan. And for the United States to defend Taiwan would be very, very challenging.
That's Bonnie Glaser. She's Senior Advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bonnie, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.